We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Earlier this month, people in Europe and really people around the world were celebrating the fall of the Berlin Wall, hailing this as a victory for civil society. Our guest for this hour, historian Stephen Kotkin, has another view. He says that the fall of communism was not so much a matter of people power as it was the result of corrupt establishments, party bosses, secret police, the top military commanders. This morning we'll be talking with Stephen Kotkin about his recent book, Uncivil Society. It tries to look closely at three countries, East Germany, Poland, and Romania, using them as case studies to try to explain communism's collapse from within. The book is out now. It's published by Modern Library, if you'd like to look at it. Our guest, Stephen Kotkin, is Rosengarten Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at Princeton University, with a joint appointment as Professor of International Affairs in the Woodrow Wilson School. If you're joining us this morning by telephone. Now, as we talk, listeners are invited into the conversation, provided that they can keep their comments brief and they can stay on the topic. But if you can do that, that'd be great. We'd be happy to have your call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Professor Kotkin, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for joining us. We appreciate
it. Thanks for the invitation.
Maybe the place to start is to define our two basic terms here and do a little contrasting. I think probably people understand what civil society means, and that that's connects with what is the sort of the conventional explanation of what happened in Eastern Europe. That people will argue that what really happened was that there was a demand from the grassroots for change, and that these governments simply couldn't resist that kind of pressure, that it was the result of popular demand for change. You say, no, that's really not what happened at all.
You know, there were a million people in Tiananmen Square in the summer of 1989 in China. A million people, and 20 years later, we still have the Chinese dictatorship. There were between 2 and 3 million people on the streets of Iran just this past summer. Also courageous people, also demanding changes or even the overthrow of the regime. But the Iranian regime held this particular summer. Back in 1989 in Poland, there were no street demonstrations whatsoever. And the Polish communist regime was the first to fall. So it's our view that the people power thesis, the idea that surging crowds hitting the streets, demanding the overthrow of authoritarian regimes, the people power thesis just doesn't really work. You need a different explanation. The different explanation, we believe, is when the elites cave, when the establishment gives up, when the establishment is demoralized. The reason we call it an uncivil society, that is, the reason we call the establishment, the communist establishment, an uncivil society, is because it was fully organized. It had school systems, alumni networks, resorts, closed distribution networks for food and imported goods. It had patronage networks. It was a fully organized society. But it was not organized by the rule of law, and it was not constrained by the rule of law. That's why we call it an uncivil society. Civil society is a widespread term in the academy, in the public realm, among journalists, among foundations that support the struggle against authoritarianism. Civil society is merely the way rule of law states, rule of law countries, are organized. That is to say, if I want to do something and that's what I want to do is legal, if someone tries to stop me, I can use the state, I can use legal machinery, I can use the judiciary to back up what I want to do. As a self-organizing member of society, I have recourse to a rule of law state to help me get what I want. This is really not possible under communism. We have a confusion whereby the strategy to oppose authoritarian regimes takes the name of civil society, and as if civil society, a fight to have a civil society against this authoritarian regime. And we make that as if that strategy of opposition, that resistance, into a sociological fact and begin to attribute all sorts of change and power to them when it's really not an effective strategy, as we saw in China in June 89 and as we saw in Iran this past summer. You got to see what makes the establishments give up, what makes them collapse.
And here the argument you make is that if you go back to the beginning of the post-war period or the Cold War period, that we have a situation here where we have these two competing political economic philosophies in the East and in the West. And that what happened was in the capitals in these countries, these satellite countries of the Soviet Union, the leadership there over time began to see, and certainly it wasn't hard to see, that they were falling farther and farther behind economically as Western Europe, and I suppose Germany would have been the leading countries, just did spectacularly well. And they knew that they weren't doing well. Maybe their people didn't know it, but they knew it. This was something that led them to make some bad decisions, further bad decisions that I'm sure that you can talk about. But your argument is that eventually, and maybe once we get into the 80s, that they actually recognized that they had failed.
Yes. Communism was crushed. It was crushed in a daily life competition. A competition about cars and about stockings and children's shoes, a competition about oranges and bananas, and also freedom. They had tanks. They had all the weaponry imaginable. They had answers on the military side, but they didn't have answers in terms of consumer goods, daily life, and freedom. Now, communism was nothing except the antidote to capitalism. In other words, the reason communism came into being was because it was supposed to be better. It was supposed to be more abundant and morally superior than the Western system. So to the extent it was falling behind, to the extent that the capitalist system was beating communism, this undermined communism's very reason for being. As time went on, the communist establishments began to feel this enormous psychological pressure of living under the increasing advance of the West and the inability of the communists to keep pace. They were falling farther behind. Let's remember, in the late 1940s, when communism is imposed on Eastern Europe, the so-called Soviet satellites of Eastern Europe, when communism is imposed in the late 1940s, the communist establishments are minuscule. They're tiny minorities. In all of Romania, there were fewer than 1,000 communists in 1947. Many had been murdered in fascist jails or by fascist police. Many had been murdered by Stalin in his purges. However, these minuscule communist establishments impose their will. They feel they're on the side of history. They think that history is not only on their side, but justifies using any means necessary. Kill, deport, lie, whatever it takes, we are the movement of history. By the time you get to the 1980s, what had been minuscule communist establishments are gigantic, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. But they lack the confidence they had only three or four decades earlier. The confidence is gone. They're now demoralized. They now see that history is not on their side. They see that they were wrong and that the West is much more dynamic. The 1930s, when we had the capitalist Great Depression, mass unemployment, fascist militarism. In the 1930s, communism could be a plausible alternative. That's one of the reasons the Soviet Union had a lot of international support. Many people inside and outside the Soviet Union felt it might be a viable alternative to Great Depression, fascist militarism, and colonies or imperialism. In the post-World War II, however, capitalism, the outside world for communism, is totally transformed. West Germany in the 1950s has GDP growth of more than 10% every single year. West Germany in the 50s is the China of today. And this was something that the East didn't anticipate but could not avoid because, as I said, either they were better than capitalism or they had no reason to exist.
And then just to take it one step further, the action that they took that perhaps guaranteed the collapse was that as they saw themselves falling further behind economically, they decided, well, we still have a chance here to compete. We can develop our industry. We can make goods that would be attractive in the West. But they said, well, to do that, though, we need some capital. We need some startup money, in a sense. So what they did was they went to Western banks and they borrowed very heavily, thinking that then if they could develop their economies, they could develop products that they could sell, and then they could pay off their loans. Well, the fact of the matter is that it didn't work. By the period we're talking about, 1989, Eastern Europe owed something like $90 billion to Western banks, and they had no way to pay it back.
Yes, you're right. I mean, today we're a little bit jaded on this. You know, in the United States, we throw $1 trillion down the rat hole, and we don't think much of it, perhaps. But $90 billion for small countries, and back in 1989, was a serious amount of money. Plus, let's remember, they had to pay it in foreign currency. They couldn't pay it in Polish zlotys or Hungarian forints or East German marks. They had to pay it in Western currencies, in tradable, exchangeable foreign currencies. And so the only way they could do that was if they could sell products on Western markets and get paid in Western currency for those products. The loans began in 1970 in East Germany and Poland, and it seemed like a good idea at the time to many people. They were going to take the foreign currency loans, buy Western technology, modernize their economies, and thereby produce those products which they could then sell and make a leap into modernity. The slogan in Poland was build a second Poland. Build a second Poland or double GDP in a decade. Of course, it didn't work, as you pointed out. They didn't have those goods to sell. There was no demand on Western market for the Eastern goods. The only way they could pay back the hard currency loans was to take out more hard currency loans. It became a kind of Ponzi scheme. The Hungarians needed $1 billion a year in foreign currency only to pay the interest on their loans, not to pay down the principal. The Poles needed $2 billion a year to pay the interest only on their massive debts. So this was a conundrum that further demoralized the communist elites. Not only were they falling farther and farther behind capitalism, which was their only reason for existence, was competition for capitalism. Not only were they falling farther and farther behind, but they were now dependent on the capitalists. They were now dependent for loan money, for Western money, just to stay afloat. At the same time, they were using that money to import Volvos and Mercedes-Benzes and all sorts of Western consumer goods, partly to mollify their populations and partly just to live well themselves. So imagine, you exist because you're supposed to be better than capitalism, and you're totally financially dependent on capitalism, and all of your luxury in your life and even some of your daily life necessities have to be imported from the capitalists. This was massive psychological pressure and helped demoralize these large communist establishments in the 1980s.
Yeah, and just to sort of add one further element, one of the points you make is in these countries we did indeed have these enormous establishments. There were enormous numbers of people that were employed one way or another in supporting the state. in vast government bureaucracies and secret police and the military, and that a lot of these people really depended on their jobs. Some of them lived very well, and they didn't get where they were by making waves. And so they were really disinclined to make waves. Sounds like they pretty much were just going along to get along.
Yes. When the problems arose, they found themselves paralyzed. They found themselves unable to address the situation. You know, the outside world changed. Capitalism changed. It got much better. It's sort of like moving the goalposts in sports. The world changed. It wasn't their doing. They didn't see it coming. But they themselves couldn't change. They couldn't react. They had no strategies beyond the loan system. Now, they tried. They tried to use that loan money to do things. The East Germans built a computer industry with part of the loan money that they borrowed from the West Germans. The problem was the East German computer industry wasn't very good. It couldn't compete. Not only did it have the problem of West Germany and the entire Western Europe, but East Asia began to rise in the 70s also, as you recall. So between Taiwan, South Korea, Singapore, and Hong Kong, others learned that they could play the game of manufactured goods at low cost but much higher quality. And so these communist regimes were in a way paralyzed, but so what? Every time they had gotten into trouble before, every time there had been a crisis, every time people had come out on the streets or there had been strikes, the Soviet Union led a crackdown. And so the Soviets had 665,000 troops in Eastern Europe in the 1980s, including 380,000 in East Germany alone. These were the best Soviet troops, the ones in East Germany. So it was a kind of what me worry. That is to say, no matter how deep my problems, nobody is ever going to let these regimes collapse. Moscow will, in the final analysis, save the day. And here's where they got upended a second time. Mm-hmm. Mikhail Gorbachev came to power in 1985, and he kept telling them privately that they had to solve their own problems. No one knew exactly what this meant. No one really envisioned that these regimes might collapse, so they weren't sure that what this meant was Gorbachev would let them go. In fact, Gorbachev, we're not sure, was 100% on board with letting these regimes collapse. There was some waffling. There was some ambiguity, but clearly, after 1985, and certainly after his speech at the UN in December 1988 and into early 89, Gorbachev was making noises that the East Europeans are on their own. And when push did come to shove, it was only months after he made that speech, only months after he told them they were on their own publicly, that they collapsed.
And here, I think this is an important point that you want to make. Here in the United States, we like to credit the pressure of the West, particularly of the United States, and the guy who gets a lot of the credit, at least in some people's minds, is Ronald Reagan, both for moral political leadership and some realist, I think, would say it was had more to do with the willingness of the United States to spend whatever it took to outspend on defense the Soviet Union. In any case, you seem to be saying that of these two men, that Gorbachev really had a lot more to do with the fall of communism than Ronald Reagan.
Yes, just like there's a lot of confusion about people power and how powerful people power is, how people power can supposedly peacefully knock down an authoritarian regime on its own. There's also confusion about the role of Ronald Reagan. The usual version of the Ronald Reagan story is that he built up the U.S. military, he launched the Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars, and this was a challenge that the Soviets couldn't meet, and they essentially cried uncle. Now, the problem with that story, the problem with the SDI or Star Wars version of Reagan's influence, is that those who make that argument on behalf of Reagan don't refer to any internal Soviet documentation. They just assert it. They assert it because they believe Reagan was a strong and good president. If you look at the internal documentation from the Soviet military-industrial complex, if you look on the inside of the Soviet regime, You see that they weren't very worried about Star Wars. The KGB's internal analysis of Star Wars was that it would never work. In fact, I think we're 20 years or so later, beyond the Reagan presidency, and Star Wars is still not a reality. So that was one of the things that you can say the KGB got right. So it wasn't the military pressure from Reagan that had the important effect. You could also argue that the Soviet Union was good at military stuff. In fact, it was the only thing the Soviet Union was very good at. And still today, Russia has a military-industrial complex, and China, where President Obama is today, gets 95% of its weapons from Russia, from Russia's military-industrial complex. So the Reagan story is not a Star Wars story, but Reagan did make a contribution, and it gets crowded out by the Star Wars discussion. What Reagan did was he had lifelong anti-communist bona fides. He was an anti-communist his whole life. So he had the credibility to negotiate with Gorbachev. He could go toe-to-toe with a communist, and nobody would think Reagan was soft on communism. And he could enter into arms control agreements with Gorbachev that gave Gorbachev a lot of domestic breathing room. In other words, Reagan helped Gorbachev domestically. Now, what this meant in practice was Gorbachev accidentally dismantled the communist system from within, having some of this extra running room that Reagan gave him internationally. So Reagan did make a contribution, but it was Gorbachev, especially Gorbachev's failure to understand the consequences of his own actions that destabilized the Soviet Union, and Reagan should get credit for having had the vision and the anti-communist bona fides to negotiate with Gorbachev and to give Gorbachev that room. I wrote about this in a previous book a number of years ago called Armageddon Averted. The current book, Uncivil Society, takes up the East European story, the fall of the wall, and the repercussions of Eastern Europe back onto the Soviet Union.
So you think that Gorbachev believed that he could control the forces that he was unleashing with the kind of reforms and liberalizations that he was undertaking in the Soviet Union? You believe that he thought that was something that would not get away from him?
Yes. Mikhail Gorbachev came to power in 1985. He was the only person in the Politburo who was in his 50s. He was mid-50s. The next closest person was just about 70, and several of them were in their 80s. The previous people in the office before Gorbachev had died in a short period of time. He was the first one who was not on a dialysis machine, not on an oxygen tank, not drooling on himself during television appearances. He was young, lively, and energetic. What he brought in addition to youth was a kind of 1960s generation belief in the reform of communism. It was called socialism with a human face. It had been tried in Czechoslovakia back in 1968, and Soviet tanks had come in and put it down bloodily. The socialism with a human face, the more liberal or liberalized version of a Soviet system, was Gorbachev's vision. The problem with this vision was that the more you reform the system, the more the system began to collapse. You gave people a little bit of freedom, they wanted a lot of freedom. You gave them a little bit of market mechanisms in the economy, they wanted more market mechanisms in the economy. You allowed people to form various different informal groups for discussion. They wanted to break the Communist Party's monopoly on power. So reform was an idea of Gorbachev's generation, but in practice it was deadly for the communist system. But the flip side of this, the flip side of Gorbachev's belief in socialism with a human face, was that he wouldn't use force. The very reason he launched these reforms of trying to liberalize, open up, get the system as a system to perform better. The very reason he launched those reforms was the same reason he refused to use massive force to crack down when the consequences were destabilizing of his reforms. So Gorbachev kept the Soviet troops in the barracks in 1989 when the wall came down. Let's remember that Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister of Britain, and François Mitterrand, the President of France, called Gorbachev as the wall was coming down and told him to do something. They were afraid that if the wall fell, Germany would be unified again, and there would be this big German power on the continent. Gorbachev, the communist, the socialism with a human face true believer, not Thatcher, not Mitterrand, is the one who let the wall come down despite their advice. Now, Gorbachev didn't foresee that the wall was going to come down. He didn't introduce his policies to knock down the wall. He thought that the system would revive itself. He thought that the system would get a second wind. However, once it was destabilized, once the wall was breached on November 9, 1989, Gorbachev let it happen. He didn't use force to try to keep it together, to try to hold on. And that's really the most important contribution he made. And in fact, that's the reason we didn't have an Armageddon or a colossal bloody mess, which is what usually happens when empires collapse.
Yeah, and I think one of the points that you make is that maybe one of the most significant facts of the 20th century, the fact that the collapse of communism was peaceful as it was.
You know, we were afraid of them for a reason. The Cold War was not a mistake. The Soviet Union needed to be contained. The Soviet Union was a system that was highly detrimental, mostly to its own people. That's not to say everything we did during the Cold War was smart. We did many things that were self-defeating. We did many things that, at the time, not only in retrospect, people opposed. However, the Cold War was a necessary struggle. The Soviet Union was armed to the teeth. It had 40,000 nuclear weapons, and it had the delivery systems to bring those nuclear weapons right into our cities. Now, when the North Koreans send up a pile of junk that crashes into the sea, we get all worried. Oh, they might have missiles in North Korea, which they could use to launch nukes. Let's remember, the Soviet Union not only had 40,000 nuclear weapons, but accurate delivery systems, intercontinental ballistic missiles that could be launched from Soviet territory and hit Washington, New York, Boston, Chicago, Los Angeles, and destroy the Earth many times over. They had 40,000 tons of chemical weapons. They had a biological weapon system that the CIA didn't even know about. They were armed to the teeth, and they were completely stable in 1985, the year that Gorbachev came to power. We had no idea what went on in the Kremlin. It was a black box for us. However, we were legitimately concerned that they could destroy not only us, but the world many times over. So the fact that Gorbachev comes to power in 1985, and 4 years later, the Berlin Wall collapses peacefully, and 6 years after Gorbachev comes to power, the Soviet Union just gives up and peacefully, for the most part, dissolves itself. This is an absolutely stunning miracle that you see very rarely in world history.
We are at our midpoint, in fact, a little past our midpoint in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Stephen Kotkin. He's Rosengarten Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at Princeton University, with a joint appointment as Professor of International Affairs in the Woodrow Wilson School. And if you're interested in reading more of his thinking on this subject, you might, in fact, look at the book Armageddon Averted, The Soviet Collapse, 1970 to 2000, or also this new book that looks at what happened in Eastern Europe. The title is Uncivil Society, 1989 and the Implosion of the Communist Establishment. It's published by Modern Library, which is a division of Random House. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here locally in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Why? It's interesting to hear someone analyze it, because it's usually just glibly, sort of a naive triumphalism, which covers over so much of what happened. In the storyboard for this, there was a lot of focus on corruption, which I haven't heard a lot of talk about. But, you know, the corruption was on both sides. We have Bank of New York's owning half the Bank of Georgia and all the investment through Eastern Europe. But so I just think there's a lot of complexities. But I think that one thing that is overlooked, and a woman who was here last fall with her book, The Shock Doctrine, has a narrative about what was really going on in Poland that I think is worth examining in this regard. And her name is Naomi Klein. She's quite a public intellectual and Canadian-based, so I don't think she's drunk as much Kool-Aid as we have over here, but down here. But what happened there was the shipboard workers and a number of other workers were actually sort of, they weren't asking for capitalism. They were asking for worker-controlled collectives. They wanted to actually to sort of actually implement some kind of democratic workplace. And that's where the chink in the armor, I think, started. I think it was then manipulated, and as usual, people are co-opted and things like that happen. But it really introduces a different sort of thing. We have this image of people power maybe from the Philippines or something, which it was fundamental in shaking up things, but it was really when things got so strong that the U.S. could no longer, you know, back the butcherous regime there and let somebody else in. So that's far afield, and I'm sorry for the minor digression, but we do have this image of people power, which you were focusing on. I think people power is a lot more substantive when it comes through the kind of modalities that the Polish workers were actually talking about. So I'm curious how you would react to that.
All right. Francis Kocken?
Yes, thank you. There are a lot of things that you raised in there. Let's focus on the Polish story specifically. Poland is different. Poland has a church, a Catholic church. The whole country, communist Poland, is divided into dioceses. It's the only communist country so divided. That is to say, it's organized on the basis of church dioceses. There's a Catholic university, also completely unusual under communism. The Polish Pope is a student at that Catholic university, among many, many other Polish intellectuals. In addition, Poland does not have collectivized agriculture. It's the only communist country where the regime attempts to collectivize agriculture and then stops. They gave up. And so about 80% of the land in Poland is actually owned and controlled by the peasantry. And in addition, Poland has, unusually again, an organized working class. Every time the communist regime attempts to raise prices, which is essentially a wage cut, every time they attempt to raise prices, almost, the workers go out on strike. And many of the strikes are general strikes. That is to say, they involve almost the whole country. And so the Polish working class is deeply organized, and the communists are afraid of it. In 1970, the strikes end up producing so-called inter-factory strike committees, so that Polish factories that are striking communicate with other Polish factories that are striking and form these multi-factory or inter-factory strike committees. This is completely unusual in the communist world. So the workers are organized. Many of them are inspired by the church. We see in all the photographs of the striking workers, crosses, pictures of the Madonna, a priest saying Mass. In any case, this combination of a Catholic Poland, a worker-organized Poland, and a peasantry that's not collectivized makes Poland stand out. Poland is the only country that actually throws off communism before 1989. Between 1980 and 81, for 16 months, Solidarity is more or less de facto in legal, it's in legal existence, and it's more or less de facto alternative to the communist regime. The communist regime doesn't dissolve, but it fades into the background in 1980 and 81. And many people, including inside the Soviet KGB, are so impressed by the power of solidarity, by the power of the workers, by the appeal of the Polish Pope, who in 1978, just before the formation of Solidarity in 1980, has become the first Polish Pope ever. People are so impressed that they think this communism thing is toast. However, on December 13, 1981, the communist regime in Poland has a crackdown. 5,000 people are arrested in one night, and Solidarity is driven underground. And so all throughout the 1980s, communism is back in Poland. It's not quite the same because the crackdown is done by the military rather than the Communist Party, and it's a kind of junta regime. General Jaruzelski, the ruler of Poland in the 80s, is a military man. He's also the head of the party, but his power derives from his military background and his ability to organize the use of force, the military and the secret police. So you then have a standoff where you had a breakthrough to which for which the workers get most of the credit. You had a breakthrough in 1980-81. In the 80s, you get a standoff. The Polish regime still owes all this money, the loans that they've taken out, which they can't pay back. They cannot enforce an austerity program on the country. They lack credibility and legitimacy. So at the end of the 1980s, the Polish regime goes back to the remnants of Solidarity, which is illegal, and begins conversations towards what they call a roundtable. The regime is going to borrow some of the credibility, the legitimacy of Solidarity and Lech Wałęsa, who's won a Nobel Prize, in exchange for legalizing Solidarity again. The regime is not going to give up power. Solidarity doesn't want to take power. It's a kind of devil's bargain. Neither side likes the other. Each side is very suspicious, but they go into a deal called the Roundtable in 1989, which is going to introduce elections. The elections are going to be rigged. The communists are supposed to maintain a majority. And as I say, Solidarity is very reluctant to do any deal with this communist regime, which has put them in jail. The crazy end result of this process, of this roundtable, of these elections, is that the communist regime gets totally humiliated by their incompetence, the way they've organized the elections. So in Poland, you end up with a Solidarity prime minister, the first non-communist prime minister in any East European country since communism was imposed. The elections in Poland take place June 4th, 1989, the same day of the crackdown in China in Tiananmen Square. Now, this breakthrough in Poland, which neither side anticipated, neither side really wanted, is shocking to everybody. But your caller's point, what kind of happened to the working class organization? What happened to those people who made this possible? The ones who had the courage to go out on strike and defy the police and self-organize and challenge the communist regime and make the Solidarity breakthrough, and provided the muscle to those intellectuals who negotiated the roundtable, negotiated the electoral process, which the communists muffed, and ended up putting a Solidarity prime minister in power in communist Poland in 1989. What happened to all of that from the point of view of the workers themselves? Well, unfortunately, they got not the kind of utopia that they had envisioned. They did not get social justice and social welfare. They did not get worker ownership of all of the property. Instead, they got the market economy. Private property was not something they were pushing for in 1980-81 during the revolt, but private property is what came. The market is what came, and this had a very deleterious effect on many of those communities that had opposed the communist regime. So, in fact, Solidarity and communism end up almost disappearing together, as it were, even though they were opposed to each other, fought for so long, they were kind of tied to each other, and when the market reforms come in, Solidarity suffers a serious blow.
We just have about 10 minutes here. I have some other callers, and I want to try to get them in. Our guest, by the way, is Stephen Kotkin. He's professor of history at Princeton. Questions welcome here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And next up, we have someone in Decatur, line 2. Hello.
Yes, excellent crystal clear analysis. I'd like to have you look forward a little bit. It seems to me it's kind of obvious that capitalism is also starting to crumble under its own weight. Capitalism companies are not rewarded for doing the right thing, and as we face the future, it looks like companies should be doing the right thing, and basically they can't because they're too competitive. So I'd like to have you look ahead and see how you think that we face a future here in this country under capitalism, and it seems to me we're also way overextended, and we may crumble, and how do you suppose we're going to fall? I'll hang up and listen to your comments. Thanks.
Yes, thank you for that question. I sometimes make a joke, it's probably not very funny, that communism's collapse is a mystery because it had an economy like Detroit, and it had a finance minister like Bernie Madoff, and it had a president like Angelo Mozzillo of Countrywide. So it's a mystery why they collapsed. But I think you're right. I think we have deep and fundamental problems here in the United States. I think we've been in denial about those problems, and we have difficulty confronting them, let alone solving them. But the difference between our system and the communist system is that we have these self-correcting mechanisms. Whatever one thinks, there's cheating, there's fraud, there's collusion, there's monopoly power, the market is still a very important self-correcting mechanism. Same thing for democracy. There are money interests, there's corruption, there are things that shouldn't be allowed to happen that happen, but democracy is a self-correcting mechanism ultimately. So the hope is that some version of the market plus democracy will act as correcting mechanisms and help us solve some of these problems, because the communists had no corrective mechanisms whatsoever. Having said that, however, I think we are a little bit stuck. The current situation, it's hard to see how we get where we need to get 10, 15, 20 years down the line from where we are right now.
All right, so another caller, Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello. I'm in Urbana now, but in 1989, I am a Romanian, and I was there, and well, I agree generally with the general picture which you painted: economic problems and low productivity, huge aspiration toward the West. How big things happened there, and what I would say is that in this context, the popular movement, what happened in Poland, definitely played a big role. But as things get worse, the role of a part of KGB, I mean Russian KGB, the German KGB, the Romanian KGB, started to play an essential role in developing the change which happened in 89. Namely, I will tell you just a small story. In September, I voted against your election of Ceausescu, and I was thrown out from my institute, and believing that, look, the changes have started to happen in Germany, I won't be taken by our KGB and put in jail. And that indeed didn't happen. Rather than that, one time I was taken from the street just walking, probably in November, and I was taken into the KGB building, and I was explained that, look, just wait, don't worry, in a few months will happen a change, and we will still be here. That means that was in the Pitești city in Romania, and what I'm trying to say is KGB started to organize the change, and that happened for certainly a long time and in the context of Gorbachev and so on. So when talking about change, we need to consider this without with only popular movement, it would be would have been very hard to have this change. Rather, only after KGB started to organize, and how the things happened was in this way: in December in 1989, KGB one night started to shoot at the military bases in Bucharest, so the military cannot get out to help Ceausescu staying in power after. So I'm trying to suggest that it was essential that a part of KGB saw the need for a change, and they wanted to a change after which they stay in power.
Yeah, okay. I take your point. We only have a couple of minutes left, so I would like to get Professor Kotkin's reaction to the story that the caller has told.
Yeah, very, very briefly. The story we like to tell ourselves is the freedom story. The freedom story, the surging crowds, the heroic intellectuals, the civil society, the defiance of authoritarianism, and pop, it disappears. In Eastern Europe, the story that's much more popular is the stolen revolution story. That's the story whereby there was a revolution, but blink your eye, and there they are. The KGB, that is to say the secret police, are still there. The officials are still there. They own the businesses. They own the property. They allowed the revolution to happen, or they caused the revolution, and then they stole it after the fact. The trouble with the stolen revolution thesis is that none of these guys foresaw or wanted the systems to collapse. They were doing quite well under the previous system. They were not suffering. So they didn't envision, nor did they desire, that the systems collapsed. The systems collapsed on top of them. They imploded within them. And so they were left with to pick up the property, but picking up the property was not the reason these things collapsed. However, it's very important, your caller is right, to focus on these establishments and what they were doing and not doing, and especially what's important is how they were demoralized and didn't fight to the last drop of blood to uphold their systems.
We're again getting down to just a couple of minutes left. One thing that I wanted to ask you about was whether it might not have been possible. You talked about the fact that we did not see huge numbers of people in the streets in Eastern Europe demanding reform, nothing like Tiananmen Square and nothing like the kind of demonstrations that we saw following the recent elections in Iran. But I wonder whether the fact that, as you argue, that the leadership, the uncivil society part of this, the leadership essentially gave up, made it possible for small numbers of people actually to push the government, these governments, and that the governments were demoralized to the point where they simply didn't push back. So maybe a small number of people could actually have an effect disproportionate to their numbers.
Yes, you're exactly right. That's another one of the arguments in the book, which is to say that these regimes that had been demoralized needed a shove. In Poland, they capitulated accidentally. They didn't realize, going into the round table and the organization of elections, that they were going to get voted out of power, as it were. In the other countries, they were not going to a round table. They were ambiguously stating that they were going to hold on, and they were shoved. They were shoved at first by small numbers of people, and then it spiraled and it spiraled and it spiraled. 70,000 peace marches in the East German city of Leipzig on October 9th, 1989, marched in the streets carrying candles amid rumors that a crackdown was coming. There had been beatings of demonstrators all throughout September 1989 in East Germany. And so the possibility of a crackdown was very real. And these peace marchers were courageous. And they marched around Leipzig October 9th, 1989, and they were not forcibly dispersed. In other words, the regime crackdown failed to materialize. Once these regimes are challenged and fail to crack down, then the challenge becomes bigger and bigger. It emboldens other people to come out into the street so that soon enough, from very few people at the beginning in the fall of 1989, you soon get into the hundreds of thousands of people in the streets by November and December 1989. Out of nowhere, it seems, and the failure to crack down at the beginning has brought about this kind of spiral, what we call a political bank run, where the people lose their fears, go out into the streets, and demand things, and the regime, paralyzed, demoralized, fails to crack down.
Mm. We're essentially at the point here we have to finish it. Is there some sort of last thought that you'd like to leave with folks?
The fall of communism in Eastern Europe is a magnificent story. Eastern Europe, for the most part, is now inside the European Union. They've been transformed into democratic polities with the rule of law. This is an amazing achievement, and we should be very happy about the fall of the wall and the way things have gone, and especially the way Germany's unification has defied all those people who are worried. There is a problem, however, and that's beyond the European Union, farther to the east, where there has not been transformation, where the internal institutions are not the way they are in the European Union, where there is no institutionalized rule of law. Ukraine, the Caucasus, Russia, Central Asia. This is a story that's still unfolding, and we're not sure where it's going to go. Mm-hmm. That makes us a little bit ambivalent. On the one hand, Eastern Europe in the European Union, great story. On the other hand, farther east, not transformed, and a little bit worrisome.
Our guest, Stephen Kotkin, professor of history at Princeton. The joint appointment is professor of international affairs in the Woodrow Wilson School. Professor Kotkin, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on. It was my pleasure.